And welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Bob Gartner is on the controls. Thank you, Bob. And, you know, I was just saying before the show started, I mean, there's so much stuff in the news. I don't even know what to talk about, isn't it? It's like an embarrassment of riches, if you want to call all the horrible, scary stuff going on riches. It's kind of like bizarro riches, if you know what I mean. Okay, first, let me do my public service thing. Remember, there is a big election on November 8th, and you must be registered by October 8th. Time is running out. It is now August 15th, so you got like 6 or 7 weeks. You can go to harrisvotes.com, and you can find out how to register, find out if you're registered. I don't think you can register online, but you can get the documentation to register, instructions on how and where to register. You can also go, if you're not in Harris County, you can go to votetexas.gov. That's vote and then Texas, one word, .gov. That's the Secretary General, the State Secretary of State's office, and they can help you in a similar way. If you're registered, where to register, how to register, guide you to your county's county clerk. So this is a really, every election is important, but this is a really important election. So make sure you're registered to vote, and then make sure to vote. It ain't so hard. You can also get those links at my website, thinkwingradio.com. I also have links to basically everything that I have listed to talk about, plus the stuff I never get to. So I also upload my shows up there. I think the site is interesting. It has a number of articles and stuff. So, whatever. Okay, thinkwingradio.com. You can also support KPFT at kpft.org. Go to the tip jar, tell them Think Wing Radio sent you, contribute what you can. This is, as usual, an open forum. I'll throw out some stuff that I've run across, but you can talk about anything that has been on your mind or that pops into your head while we're talking. The number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738, occasionally known as 713-526-KPFT, or by some people as 713-JAM KPFT, I think? I don't know. I hate that stuff. I prefer numbers. 713-526-5738. Okay, just samples of some of the great news we're getting in the world. Chinese media hints at war with Vietnam over rocket launchers, saying it's a terrible mistake. Those of you who follow the news or occasionally hear me mention it, there is a lot of stuff going on in the South China Sea primarily, but also in the East China Sea by Korea and Japan. And it's very, very tense there. You know, increasing militarizations, countries choosing sides, the United States now agreeing to sell weapons to Vietnam, which is obviously a counterbalance to China. The United States and India are creating a counterbalance to China. Australia is starting to have to pick sides, something they really don't want to do. I mean, I'm telling you, this is potentially a serious, serious mess. And when you have a headline like, "Terrible mistake," Chinese media hints at war with Vietnam over rocket launchers. Vietnam is putting missiles on some disputed islands just in case the Chinese get, you know, possessive. So that's one bit of good news, sarcastically speaking. Also, apparently bombing hospitals is now a thing. The United States, oh, that's a squeaky microphone. The United States accidentally, and I do believe it was accidental, the United States accidentally bombed a hospital, I think it was sometime last year. But apparently the Syrians and the Russians and now the Saudis, apparently in spite of like international treaties against this sort of thing, I mean, I understand hospitals can have a strategic value. I mean, the fact is warriors go there to be healed, to go back into combat. And destroying hospitals from a strategic standpoint, not from a humane standpoint now, but from a strategic standpoint, hospitals help to put people back into productive use, either as civilians producing whatever value they produce as civilians, or as soldiers. And, you know, one of the things about landmines, there's a reason that landmines are not really intended to kill. They are intended to maim, because that accomplishes multiple objectives. It disables a warrior, theoretically, and then it absorbs the resources of the warrior's country in order to collect him, treat him, care for him. And apparently it is now a thing that some countries increasingly are deciding that hospitals, at least as far as they see, they consider legitimate targets of war, in spite of the fact that there are treaties and humane considerations against that sort of thing. So apparently it is believed that Saudi warplanes attacked a hospital in Yemen with Doctors Without Borders, killed at least 15 people, mostly children. A lighter side of the news, the mayor in Corsica. Yes. Oh, that's always good news. Are you saying I should take them while I can get them? Okay, we are. I'm sorry, I don't know how much you could hear of Bob's side of the conversation. Apparently, we're having some phone problems, which may mean that we're dropping calls involuntarily. So it's a volume issue. Okay, which means that you may hear me and I may not hear you, which means that I just get to, you know, pontificate. All right, why don't we try the phones? I mean, I just want to say this one last thing. The mayor in Corsica, which is a French island, has banned something called burkinis, B-U-R-kinis. Apparently, they are a new bathing suit fad for Muslim women so that they can be covered and still go swimming. If you think about, like, 1910 bathing suits, it's kind of like that, except it still resembles a burqa. And apparently, the Corsican mayor decided to ban them because there was some violence. It's a messy story. It's like, it wasn't so much the burkinis that were a problem, but people were taking pictures of the women in the burkinis, and that caused some ruckus, and then you ended up with a big fight, and the mayor just, and they just decided, you know what, we're just going to ban the burkinis. So again, the victims pay the price. Okay, let's take our first phone call. We do have open line, 713-526-5738. Jerry, you're on the line. Let's see if I can hear you.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, man, can I hear you? Yes.
Okay, maybe he's got that problem with.
Don't know. Maybe you got a great phone.
What?
Maybe you've got a great phone. But anyway, so what's going on?
It's on this end, Jerry, I've determined.
I got it.
So as long as I don't move any wires, we should be okay.
Okay, so Jerry, what's going on?
That's stuff to do in there. Anyway, I worked at that control board before many moons ago, and it's easier said than done.
I've never been able to get those things to work for me.
I just wanted to say something about, you know, the two guys who hung up on you who were complaining about it being the same old thing, two white people, yada, yada, yada.
Oh, the guys that hung up on me? The guys that hung up on me a week ago?
Yeah, yeah, and everything. I just want to say a couple of things to those gentlemen and to also point out some things to other people. And that is, you know, basically, I'm sorry, but, you know, a man versus a woman in U.S. politics is an unprecedented thing. Now, they may both be white, but I'm sorry, you know, to complain about that, especially when Obama's still in office. And once again, we have a woman getting nominated. You know, you just want to sit there, both of those guys. I wonder, you know, I guess they're against women. I don't know.
Well, I'm going to insert something here. Obama, as a black or multiracial president, however you want to categorize him, if people had shown up to vote in 2010, he would have been able to accomplish many things that now they're criticizing him for not accomplishing. The fact is, the people did not elect allies for him. They elected adversaries, because the people who would have elected allies for him didn't show up at the polls. So when people gripe about it, you know, look to yourselves, folks.
Yeah, that is a problem. And also, and that goes back to, like you said, the whole issue of redistricting and everything, which we do every 10 years when we have the the census and all that, and I couldn't believe how asleep at the wheel the Dems were at that, with that whole thing. But anyway, you and I both complained about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, one thing I want to say, though, is that, you know, there's suddenly a little bit of an opening potentially in American politics here on the race front and on the sex front and all that. But you're still going to have to appeal to white men and everything. We would run this candidate, but he'd have to actually make some kind of appeal to white men.
White men gave the vote to women, and that may be distasteful from an emotional standpoint, but, you know, the fact is that it happened. The women who could not vote were able to persuade the white men who could vote and got the vote. And you know what? All of us want stuff to happen right away, but unfortunately these things take years and decades and occasionally a generation, and it's annoying as heck, but that's the way it sometimes is. And messy, bloody revolutions rarely work out well. So, as aggravating as it is, activism at the far end of the spectrum and simply voting at the near end of the spectrum, voting for the people that want to do the things that you want them to do, that's how you get things done.
Yeah.
The party is the participants. If you're not participating, the party will be something else.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. But what I'm saying, though, is that basically these people are, you know, basically, you know, you having a chance to basically further your agenda and actually, you know, also get, you know, maybe more minority or women candidates out there successfully elected into Congress or wherever, whatever political positions you want them to get them elected to. But guess what? You can't sit there and just give every white guy out there the bird.
No.
And everything. And, you know, you're
they
not going
to
win by
vote.
Doing that for the next 30, 40 years. You will eventually.
The white guys still
but, you know,
vote.
Are you willing to wait 30 or 40 years? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, the white guys still vote. You can't ignore them. You can't ignore the white guys or the black guys or the brown guys. You can't ignore the white women or the brown women or the college educated.
What I'm saying, though, is that, you know, these guys were, like, complaining about same old, you know, what were they say about having to actually make an appeal, you know, like an African-American candidate, like, oh, Barack Obama actually having to make an appeal or trying to be appealing to white men or white women. You know, this is the future of American politics, folks. And if you got a problem with it, then, you know, you need to go get an attitude adjustment.
Well, I think it's worth reminding folks who forget that by the year 2050, if not much sooner, whites will be what they call a minority majority, meaning they'll be the largest single minority. You know, they might be like 48% or 45% of the population, but at 45%, they're a minority group.
That's true.
So
that's true,
everybody will be a minority.
That's right. But at 2050, though, that's still, you know, what, 35 years, 34 years out?
But you will see it happening on an evolutionary scale.
Yeah,
it's not like
right.
all of a sudden in 2050 it's there. You'll see it running like state by state, county by county. You'll see the effects.
And guess what? 2050, you'll still have to make that appeal to white voters.
Yeah, because they'll still be the largest minority.
And everything. So, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, you guys need to get an attitude adjustment. Those two guys that hung up on you need to, like, you know, get in touch with reality.
Well, I mean, I thought it was both funny and sad that they hung up on me. The second guy I thought was the funniest, where he said, I think I might hang up on you too. And I just said, go ahead. And he hung up on me. And I mean, what's more funny and pathetic than that?
Nothing.
But at least he was polite about it. I guess he could have just hung up on me, which would have been incredibly rude. So this way he suggested he might, and I gave him permission. He said, okay. And I guess that's, if you're going to hang up on someone, that's the politest way to do it.
I guess. But the thing about it is that, you know, my whole thing is that, you know, basically this is the way American electoral politics is going to play out in the future and all that. And this isn't the worst case scenario either, by the way. As we're seeing with Trump and some other people, things could be a lot worse than, you know, like an American, Asian American or Hispanic or somebody, you know, a Muslim, heaven forbid, and I don't mean that, I mean that facetiously, you know, or some Asian person or something like that, to make the, you know, has got to actually appeal to a, you know, to white voters and everything. And, you know, not necessarily on the basis of race, but on what kind of policies those people want.
You know, I can't decide what is a worse scenario? I can't decide if, like, Trump and the Republican Party sort of in general has created, subsidized, encouraged, brought out into the daylight the hate and racism and neo-Nazism that has been residing in this country. And I can't decide if we were better off suppressing it and trying to make it socially unacceptable, or if we're at this point maybe better off having it in our face and knowing where the potential adversaries are that we either need to protect ourselves against or multi-generationally try to re-educate. And it's worth noting that a lot of these people, the reasons that they believe these things is because they have been economically and socially disadvantaged.
That's true.
So that is part of the problem. That's part of the cultivated field that we as a society create that creates the favorable conditions for these people to be so embittered that they think that Nazism or some kind of fascism is an answer for them.
Yeah.
But
well, that's just
the
it, and those people are highly resentful.
From the media.
Yeah, well, but the media is nothing.
But
the media both creates and reflects society. So it's a feedback loop. It's not just the media. Anyway, I'm going to let you go, Jerry. I got three other folks on the line here.
Oh, okay, good. All right, then I'll talk to you later.
I appreciate your call as always. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. 713-526-5738 is the phone number. We have open lines. And remember that you can support KPFT. KPFT needs your support. We're 100% community supported, staffed by volunteers. Still costs us $150 an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and 366 on leap years. Every hour of every day. So whatever you can contribute, kpft.org, tip jar, Think Wing Radio, whatever you can afford. Okay, next up is Scott. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air. How you doing?
Thank you. I do not think abortion is a social issue. I think it's a personal freedom issue. And I'm pro-choice. I'm also pro-choice on marijuana. I'm pro-choice on what Pee Wee Herman was doing in a private business in the presence of like-minded customers.
Of course, it wasn't Pee Wee Herman doing it. It was Paul Rubens, but be that as it may.
Well, you want me to spell it out?
No, you don't need to.
Okay. Not something that I think is going to come up in a presidential debate.
Well, let me ask you this. Because I think this is sort of an intriguing question. Do you consider yourself a liberal, a Democrat, a libertarian? How would you buttonhole yourself?
I consider myself a liberal Democrat with a libertarian sort of liberal Democrat.
Now, you see, that's interesting because I actually think if libertarians, true libertarians, ever managed to get representation in Congress, they would be swing voters because there are a lot of things they believe that could go with liberals and there are some things they believe that could go with conservatives. It would make things really, really interesting if they were true libertarians.
Yeah. Well, I'm a libertarian sort of Democrat.
Okay.
Minimalist about criminal law. Uh-huh. I would like to decriminalize America. Well, what I mean is cut the criminal law down to the necessary bone. Certainly do not want to legalize armed robberies or
so-called victimless crimes, prostitution, regulate it instead of outlawing it.
I think Amsterdam has the right idea. I've been to Amsterdam several times.
Congratulations.
Yes, last time I was in
prostitution and marijuana, it's what everybody wants the country to be.
Yeah, I did not smoke the last time I was in Amsterdam. I ate cake.
Scott, don't they
I decided that smoke bothers my lung, bothers my throat.
Yeah, I have to tell you, marijuana is tough on the throat and the lungs, and I don't understand why people think that it's healthy.
Okay.
It may not be as injurious as some drugs, but just the smoking part of it certainly can't be good for you. The side ingredients.
And I've never smoked it. I've hardly ever smoked tobacco. Somebody insisted I try part of a cigarette once because I was against it, but I've never smoked tobacco, really.
Now, you see, I smoked for 16 years.
Uh-huh.
I started when I was about 16 because my mother and my stepfather kept cigarettes all over the house. It was kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
And I had an experience in 1982, surgical experience, without going into all the details, made me quit cold turkey. And
uh-huh.
I have not smoked a single cigarette since 1983. And
yep.
even when I was doing community theater, there were a couple of parts that required me to smoke a cigarette or a pipe, and I told them I would not do that because I don't consider that there is such a thing as an ex-smoker,
mm-hmm.
just like there's no such thing as an ex-alcoholic. We are all recovering smokers, because there isn't a day that goes by that for at least a fleeting instant I don't think of a cigarette. And there are times when I just feel like, wow, this would be the perfect moment for a cigarette.
There's trigger moments.
Yeah, trigger moments. And that convinces me that you're never an ex-smoker. You're just not smoking.
Yeah. Well, my parents both quit smoking. Now, my mother quit because she had to. My father, I think, kind of tapered off.
Mm-hmm.
He always just smoked occasionally, sometimes smoked a cigar or a pipe, but in his later years, I don't think he smoked at all. So he was exposed to the idea that smoking was not a good idea, and I crusaded against smoking to my classmates when I was a teenager, and now I'm not so prohibitionist about it, but I don't like having the smoke around me in a smoke-filled room.
I guess I'm more easygoing than that, perhaps. As long as they don't smoke in my house or my car where I have to have the residual effects, you know, if they're outside in the vicinity, I may not like it, but I'll just stay upwind of it. If they're in their house, I'm not going to tell them not to smoke. So I'm tolerant. It's, you know, what I like or dislike doesn't automatically influence how I'll try to manipulate people around me to, you know, to satisfy my particular idiosyncrasies.
Now, I quit alcohol in 1985, and since then, well, it was very difficult to tear myself away from it, but since then I haven't really wanted to, at least not when I was awake, but I still had a drinking dream the other day. I have them from time to time, and always I seem to be thinking I shouldn't be doing this.
I occasionally dream about my ex-wife, and I wake up feeling like I've had a nightmare. Dreams are nasty things, man. You can't do anything about them.
You know, these drinking dreams have some connection to my real life.
No doubt.
I have other dreams that seem to have little connection.
My dad died in 1980, and to this day, I occasionally have dreams of him being alive, and it's like, you know, unresolved issues that try to get worked out in your dreams. It's just, dreams are like that, and sometimes they're helpful, and sometimes they're creepy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I got a couple of other folks on the line, Scott. Is there anything you want to wrap up with, or can I let you go?
I'm through.
Great. Thanks so much for calling.
Scott.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Bob, I suddenly blocked out on your name. Bob Gartner. Thank you. Bob Gartner. See, it's age, man. It's just age. Bob Gartner is on the controls. I always appreciate him. He does a nice job. And KPFT.org is where you go to support the station. Go to the tip jar. And thinkwingradio.com is where you go to my website to listen to shows going back as far as May of 2010, as well as some articles that I have written. Okay, so Kevin up next. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Mike. Appreciate you. It feels like winter out there. It's not 100 degrees, so I guess.
Yeah, well, when it's under 90, man, it's time for the jackets.
Yeah, it feels good.
They call him the streak.
Look at that. Look at that. Yeah. So in regards to your voting conversation,
uh-huh.
Niece approached me not too long ago with her paper for school, and she asked me about elections, and I told her, as long as we have 13 straight ticket states in the Republic, that after 8 years of either party, the populace tends to favor the other side as far as average, meaning after 8 years of Bush or, you know, whatever, or Reaganomics, that's 12 years, or 12 years Obama or Clinton, the populace starts swinging, that pendulum goes the other direction.
Well, the swing voters do. I mean, I have what I call, and I've mentioned it before, my 40-20-40 rule.
Okay.
40% of the population will pretty much always vote one way, and 40%
yep.
of the population will pretty much always vote the other way. And the 20% in the middle, the ones that only pay attention like the last 6 or 8 weeks of any given election, if at all, those are the ones you vie for.
And so you take that 40-40-20 and you add 13 straight tickets states. And that's probably more toward your 20 because they'll be more reactive. And so,
I think they're more likely to be ticket splitters. That 20 is more likely to be ticket splitters.
I agree. Do you remember when Bill went against Rick Perry and there was like three other candidates like Grandma Strayhorn?
Bill White, you mean?
No. Was it before that against Perry? Was it Chris Bill?
I don't know.
He almost won about 10 years ago. And Strayhorn and Kinky Freeman.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I'd be hard-pressed to name which year they ran, but I do remember they ran.
It was like 2005 or 2004, I think. But anyway, I just thought that 20% to me seems to be part of the straight ticket states that tend to...
You know, I don't... I mean, I can understand you can argue it both ways. I don't have a problem with a straight ticket. I think that for people that are going to vote straight ticket anyway, and usually I pretty much do, it's a convenience. And you can still split your ticket after hitting the straight ticket. You can go to, like, if there's some particular person of the opposite party that you like, you can hit the straight ticket and then just go to that person and make an exception for them. So it's a convenience factor. But I think also, you know, it goes back to something else we were discussing with Jerry, that if you're going to elect a leader, it pays to elect his allies, or her allies. If you agree with the positions they have, and if you agree with the policies they want to initiate, why would you then persist in electing people that will fight them every step of the way? I mean, that's essentially what happened in 2010. It happened to Clinton in 1994. If you don't if you don't elect allies, then of course nothing gets done, or of course you end up with the worst of all possible worlds because compromise, compromise, compromise.
I agree. But when you straight ticket, you actually remove seats or, you know, judges of the other party that are actually good. And
well,
so,
but you can make exceptions. And of course, in many states, even with a straight ticket, in many states, you have nonpartisan judges. You still have to go down the line for the judges in many states.
Right, but the average, I think, is the easy way out for most people not to research. And you write the Contract for America in '94, or the exodus of the Republican lobbying in 2010 to the swing. It was 2006 for the Democrats, and then it went back the way. So. Yeah, we kind of, you know, I still feel, you know, the local votes for your sidewalks and bills in prisons are still, your vote does count.
Those are critical votes, and those are the votes that people are less likely to show up for.
That's sad.
It's ironic. Yeah. It's sad and ironic.
Okay, well, I'll jump off. But I thought more about, you know, as we try to share this history with people, and sometimes it's not receptive. You ever heard of Carol Quigley?
Can't say as I have. Not to my memory.
It's called Tragedy and Hope, and he was allowed to sit in during the buildup of the roundtable and the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And these are the folks who wanted to conquer without, you know, the blood and money that they did, like in 1812, the British did. So they figured they would win the masses by, you know, values, academic and social and such. So if you get a chance, just look at the highlights. If you can actually see true history, how it's played out.
And what's it called?
Tragedy and Hope.
Tragedy and Hope. I'll try to remember to look it up.
Yeah, so you want to look for true history. It's out there, but you ever heard of, what's the word, despotism?
I know the word, surely.
And, like, you know, you would think, like, China would write history that would favor their government. Do you think it's possible they do the same in our academic career?
Well, you know, I have said for many years that there are three versions of history, the winner's version, the loser's version, and the truth.
And which one is usually all but the truth, I think?
Well, I think, well, for example, the Texas Board of Ed, because it's so right-wing, they make no bones about the fact that they want to twist history in a way that makes the United States look better, that makes Texas look better. You see, my feeling, and I think I can explain it very briefly, you can teach history in this country any way you want, but the people that are not in this country, they know their history. And
right.
We might as well know why they're ticked off at us.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I like to use as an example, during the War of 1812, pretty much every American student learns that the British burned Washington, D.C. in 1812.
Mm-hmm.
What is less frequently taught is why the British burned Washington in 1812. Do you know why?
Well, we're reducing to colonial status.
Because
one famous person said.
No, because the Americans who thought that they could conquer Canada and make a greater United States, that was the goal, part of the goal of the War of 1812, they had burned the city of York, which I think today may be Toronto or perhaps Ottawa, but at that time York was the capital of Canada. So the Americans had burned the capital of Canada at York, and the British, not allowing this to go unanswered, they decided they made a very specific expeditionary force to go up the Potomac and burn the government buildings in Washington. They did not set fire to any non-government buildings, although, of course, fire isn't controllable. But they were very disciplined, and that was the reason they burned Washington. And it's really the second half of the historical story, but you only learn that half in many cases.
Well, I won't go off.
I just want to say, the Canadians, they know that story.
Right.
There's no reason we should.
These are portions of history. I would say then that. Oh my goodness, where to start? I don't know. Okay, start on the monkey organ on this one, but I would say that in academic, like even Ann Richards, when she did No Child Left Behind, that was her brainchild, and it was a good thing, but it turned into, you know, test-taking, into memorization and burn your fundamentals, your leisure arts, and all the four basics, and go into memorization and the funding for that, you know, for the percentage of students to pass grade levels K through 12 became the primary instead of teaching the four basics.
You know, it's a weird thing. On the one hand, I have some knowledge of the fact that a lot of things that I was not taught until I got into junior high school have been pushed down into the elementary school level, which I find absolutely remarkable.
But
the point I want to make is, even though I went to school during the baby boom, when there were 45 kids in a class, and sometimes you were on split session because there weren't nearly enough schools, and in spite of that, I often feel that overall I got a better education than a lot of kids get today, in the sense that because teachers had a little bit more freedom, the teachers that loved what they did taught a little off the book. So you learned extra things, and I really appreciate that part of my education.
Right, and so to the point then would be, we then went into what's, you know, now called Common Core. And now I worked in K through 12 for several years. I still have my TRS, but I don't want to bring the crazy stuff in. But if you look up who are the authors, you know, the frameworkers of Common Core, you'd be surprised. It's more of a collective instead of the fundamentals that you appreciate and I did going to school.
But you know what? I actually, at one point, I was thinking of doing a show on Common Core. I wasn't able to get anyone.
Oh, my God.
Well, but here's the thing. Common Core is a federal guideline. Whatever you're experiencing is what Texas decides.
Well, but the framework is what is
the framework is very, very broad. I mean, I'm not going to contradict anything you say. You may be much better versed on it than me. But the federal rules for Common Core are really very broad, and it's the states that do the crazy things.
Oh, there's mandated bonding. We saw one, pass just recently about the sharing the bathroom, a third grader boy going to a girl's bathroom, or you get your state funding cut. It's not one straight, shot. Like, there's a lot to it. I'm not going to get too much, but I'll leave it at this, or I'm going to get other callers. But to the college level and the funding for the academic, I listened to a professor interviewed you last night, and he explained that it took, you go past 6 years and you go into review with your peers and they figure out whether or not they're going to keep you in the system. And then once, you get past that point in your life, you can stay longer. But if you're not, you sort of not get blackballed, but you can't bark people out when you first get in.
Yeah.
And then
tenure. My wife is going through the same thing right now. Is she wants to move toward tenure. And at some point there's going to be a vote of the faculty, whether she gets tenure.
And my dad, taught political science and government honorary at U of H and other institute in Austin, and I understand a little bit how this works. But the schools that get the funding now are the ones that sort of carry, a certain, bias maybe toward certain science and arts, and well, not really arts, but I don't want to go too far on that one. Maybe another time.
Yeah, you know what? That's such another discussion that maybe if you have an opportunity, call me during the first quarter or half of the show next week, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit more, because those kinds of endowments have become incredibly politicized.
Oh, my goodness. You want that funding, the corporation is going to fund, and you better teach that. Okay, we'll talk about this.
We'll talk about it. And if you have anything you want me to look at, my email is thinkwingradio@msn.com. You can just email me some bullet points or links or something, and maybe you can then we can have a more informed conversation.
Yeah, I want to just, Mike. Yeah, that was the mayor there. It was a good picture. I want to. I'm going to start looking at it some more. But
okay.
I got you.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it so much.
Bye.
And I appreciate Greg, who's been waiting. Just let me do a quick station ID where you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Bob Gartner. I remembered. Bob Gartner is on the control board doing a fine job as usual. And you can support KPFT. We rely upon you. Go to kpft.org. Click on the tip jar. Help us out. Whatever you can afford. We're not proud. $5, $500, anything in there, we're good with. Okay, Greg, you've been a very, very patient fellow. You are on the air.
Hey.
Thank you for calling
hey,
and waiting. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I hadn't talked to you in a couple of weeks, but I've kind of been keeping up on some stuff. And I remember the last time you were on, you were talking about the movements of the Tea Party and especially Occupy. And it made me think that night about something. That both these movements kind of have similar genesis, and also, but they come at it from different perspectives.
Well,
if you look it up,
I don't know that they have a similar genesis.
Well, what I mean is, they both have the genesis of being either left out, or they come at it from a perspective ideologically of being fighting for the supposed little guy.
Yeah.
Where you have, with the Occupy movement, you're talking about young people, progressives, and maybe working class folks who have felt for a long time, like you said earlier, that they've been left out and left behind. And the same thing goes with the Tea Party, except you're talking about people from the far right who've been sold something that they've been left behind too, but they've also felt like they've been betrayed and lied to by some of the same politicians that have been telling them for years, oh, if we get into Washington, or we get into Austin, or we get into Columbus in Ohio, we're going to do this, 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 and this.
I think there's a fundamental difference. Aside from the fundamental political perspective differences, I think and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Now, Occupy, while it was seen as a spontaneous movement, yes and no. It was a spontaneous movement that had its genesis in considerable pre-planning. And then it kind of caught fire. But it wasn't a completely leaderless movement, whatever kind of image they wanted to present. There were organizers. They spent time planning how they would do this. But it became very much a creature of the base. Whereas I think the Tea Party, more demonstrably, was essentially a corporate political creation.
Yeah.
And they brought in these disenfranchised right-wing people. But it wasn't a spontaneous, like a grassroots right-wing thing that some grassroots right-wing people planned. And, you know, this was done very much at the institutional level.
Yeah, and it had to do with people of the institutional ilk, like former Texas Congressman Dick Armey.
Yeah. The Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers. I mean, it was that kind of foundation that got it started. And the propaganda of the right-wing talk shows and Fox News. And I mean, it was very much institutionally initiated, whereas I think that while there were founders of the Occupy movement, they were much closer to the grassroots level. They didn't have like $1 million in funding from the Koch brothers and from the Heritage Foundation. It wasn't an equivalent.
Thing, I don't know if you got the newest issue of Time magazine.
Do not.
With Donald Trump on the cover saying Meltdown on it.
I've seen the cover.
I've read it. I got it Friday, and I read it. And the thing I'm almost not so amazed at anymore during this election cycle is how many people, and especially the ones who really felt they've been left out, is like you guys were talking about earlier, working class people who really do feel they've been left behind, because in many ways they have.
They have.
And it's like I read the Joe Klein piece. And the point is that you're going to have to talk to these people and tell them that the jobs you're going to have, you're going to have retraining. You're going to be reeducated. You can't just walk out with a high school diploma like you did 50, 60, 70 years ago and be able to network with your dad's friends or your dad's coworkers and suddenly pop up and there'll be a job in a factory for you.
Well, I think it's actually a lot more complicated than that. You know, toward the end of my work life, I worked for, I guess, three different retail companies. I worked for Best Buy, I worked for Finger Furniture, and I worked for Conn's. And, you know, I don't care how technically savvy you are. The fact is that all of their systems are proprietary. You can be a master of systems at Sears and then walk into Conn's or Finger and know absolutely nothing about how to do anything. How do you train for that? You see, part of that problem, it's literally apples and oranges. You would have to go to, like, Sears POS school, but then when you go to Finger's, you might as well not have graduated.
Yep.
So there's more to it than that. And I will say this. There are people have all kinds of talents and let's say inabilities as opposed to disabilities. Some people are very strong mechanically. Some people are very strong technically, technologically, electronically, electrically. Those are not the same things. People have different strengths and weaknesses. Some people cannot be retrained into a high technology job. Their heads just don't work that way. And for them, if you don't have some kind of manufacturing that they can do with their hands, they can't find a job, or they'll work at McDonald's or something. So, and it's not just a matter of whether you have a high school degree or a college degree. Personally, I believe in liberal arts education. I think knowing a little of everything gives you the foundation to do anything. But it's more than that. It's like every time you walk into a company, you really need something like a formal training, and usually it's a sink or swim proposition.
Yeah, I think that doesn't like me what you just said, because I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, is it is proprietary and each company runs things differently. But I think the thing that I think I'm amazed at is how many people will listen to someone, whether it's Donald Trump now, George Wallace over 40-plus years ago in 1968,
mm-hmm.
telling them, if you just elect me, we'll go back to the way things used to be and everything will be great.
Or the way things used to look like they were, but really weren't.
Weren't. And
you know, it wasn't Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best. It just looked that way on TV.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I hate to tell a lot of people this. Folks, you've been duped for a long time. This has been coming for probably almost 40 to 50 years. And
multi-generational.
Like I was reading, I think it was Time or one of the magazines I get, where they were saying you have two sides in this electoral cycle that want to be nostalgic. You have people on the far left who want to go back to 1965 when you had the Great Society and all the culmination of everything that they were doing to be the watershed. And then you have the people who elected Ronald Reagan that want to go back to 1981 when they thought they were going to run government and control it and control the society. And these are the best way I could, best analogy is I, if you've ever watched the cartoons and you see two trains coming down a track directly at each other, that's what this is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what this
is. Yeah, I think in some ways you're right. I think this is the culmination of a growing extremism. I don't think it's so much Great Society. I think it's more like New Deal. It's
yeah,
the
New
Deal,
Deal
people
the New
versus
Deal, yeah.
the Reaganite
New Deal
people.
Versus the culmination of either conservatism, Reaganomics.
And, of course, Roosevelt,
you want to call it.
Roosevelt was practically to the left of Bernie Sanders. And
yes,
Reagan is now too liberal to get elected or nominated from. I mean, it's funny, you know, people remember history the way they want to remember it. It's kind of like going back to the three versions of history we discussed, the winner's version, the loser's
mm-hmm.
version, and the truth. Everything is more complicated than it seems from here.
Yeah, and I think this, and the thing I would ask any of us as we watch this thing play out, that if you watch a guy like Donald Trump, the thing that amazes me about this guy is just how he doesn't care what the facts are. I mean,
I have to read you. I mean, I always prepare more than I use, which is one of the reasons to go to my website, because generally about two-thirds of the plan of the show don't get on the show, but I have links to articles and all kinds of stuff. I had like three different things that I have linked to on my site. One article is called Donald Trump Tells Crowd, quote, I might lie to you. And the video is, he's talking to this one guy, and he's saying, I'll never lie to you. But to the bigger crowd, he says, I might lie to you, but this guy, whatever his name is, you I will never lie to. So it's like to everybody else, he can say anything he wants. So that's one little item I had. Another item is, no electricity and bouncing paychecks, what it was like to work for Trump magazine. And then another one is Trump could end up in prison as he continues to solicit illegal foreign donations for his campaign. And then there's another one. Trump proposes ideological test for Muslim immigrants and visitors to the U.S. And what I love is a counterpoint. The leader of Hezbollah supports Trump's claim that the U.S. created the Islamic State. Well, you know, with allies like that, man.
Yeah.
It would be funny if it wasn't so scary and pathetic.
It is. I mean, this man, and what got me, I don't know, I was listening to NPR about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think it was two, maybe three. And they had David Duke on there.
Yeah.
And David Duke is a senatorial candidate over in Louisiana. Now
he feels his time is coming.
One of the reasons he is running is because of Donald Trump.
Do you think, I mean, we talk about this so many times over elections, you know, that the Democratic Party is going to fracture, the Republican Party is going to fracture, it's the end of such and such a party. Do you think that this time the Republican Party is ready to fracture and become something else?
I think this time, yeah, because they boxed themselves into this corner. They've been doing this since probably the 80s and 90s. In fact, I was reading, I don't know if you remember, during the Republican convention, I was reading an article in the Chronicle where they talked to some black Republicans, and they said that to them, this is the whitest Republican convention in their memory.
And that's saying something.
It's saying something. Where a lot of these people, you know, it's amazing to me. And then if you still have the August 11th issue of Rolling Stone with Jared Leto on the cover, read the piece that Matt Taibbi did about the Republican convention and some of the people who were up as speakers, like Scott Baio. And,
oh, God, it was a joke.
If you guys want to win elections, Republicans, get ready for what the new century is. Don't go back to 1968 when I was like 10 years old. If you really want America to like you, don't put Rudy Giuliani in prime time trying to tell us as African Americans how we ought to act.
I'm going to give you a potential political scenario. I'm not doing this as a prediction. I'm just saying this is something I could envision.
Mm-hmm.
You have a situation now where, for the first time in my memory, significant numbers of Republicans are declining not only to support their presidential nominee, but are actually resigning their membership in the Republican Party looking for an alternative. I think that those are the signs of a fracturing party. But let's say for the sake, I mean, I can hear a lot of Democrats cheering in the background, you know, that if you have a fractured Republican Party, what that means is you're going to have a Democratic majority in almost every election because the right side vote is going to split. But here's something that I think we need to keep in mind. First of all, the moderate Republicans, one of the places they're going to think to go is the Democratic Party, which could move portions of the Democratic Party to the right. That could end up leading to a fracture of the centrist, left-of-center Democratic Party and the more left-wing Democratic Party. We could end up temporarily with four parties.
Yep.
Which would be an incredibly messy thing. So, you know, there's the old saying, be careful what you wish for. Democrats wish for the Republican Party to fracture, unintended consequences, man, happens all the time.
All the time.
And our system, by accident or design, I discussed this a couple of weeks ago, it favors a two-party system. I don't think that they intended it that way. Most of the founding fathers didn't like the idea of political parties, but it turns out that the way our system works favors a two-party system. But it'll be messy in the meantime.
It really will be. And this is an election that kind of points to people where you don't like either candidate because both of them have been in the public eye so long that they have warts and they have blemishes. And what I would ask all of us, whether we're progressives or not, ask yourself, okay, would you rather have it where, yeah, my candidate has warts, they have things I don't always agree with them on, but would you rather have it where you have a candidate that you at least believe in, it's going to be credible, that knows you could possibly get things done and win, or would you rather have an idealistic candidate that tells you what you want to hear, the things you believe in, but when they get in power, they may get the pushback that you say you don't want to see?
You know, I've followed the Clintons one way or another probably since Bill Clinton did the keynote speech in 1988. And when I hear people say, oh, the Clintons have done horrible things, they're liars, you can't trust them, they're not trustworthy, you know what? The Republicans have spent probably close to $100 million of government money trying to find something they can indict them on. They've been enduring slander and libel ever since they were in politics in Arkansas, and it's followed them into Washington. And really, at the end of the day, it's all memes. There's nothing you can stick to them. You know, Bill doesn't keep his pants zipped. That's a problem, but it doesn't affect the way he does his job. The way he does his job, he was a decent president. And they're both extremely bright people, and I keep hearing you can't trust them and this and that and the other. It's like, you know what? Show me something. There's no there there. All right.
And I've heard it, and there's somebody on your station that I hear early in the morning that says she's so worried about the Clintons and the bit by bit, the dip and the dab. Well, let's see. One of the email groups came from a conservative group who has been wanting to get whoever the Democratic nominee is because they want to still hold on to power and win back the White House.
I would say, I'm going to let you go because I got one more caller I want to get to, but I think that There is no question right now that we have targeted hacking specifically at the Democratic Party messing with this election. George Soros apparently had some of his institutional emails hacked. So, I mean, this is strictly aimed at the Democrats. There's definitely a conspiracy here. And I'm not a conspiracy guy, but this looks conspiratorial. Okay, I appreciate you calling, Greg. I hope to hear from you again.
You will.
Take care. Have a good night. Okay, last caller, Gary. You've got about a minute and a half, so I'll shut up and let you talk.
All right, well, I couldn't say what I have to say in a minute and a half. I wanted to say that America did create ISIS in 1956, President Eisenhower. And if we hadn't been so supportive of Israel's brutality, I don't think every Arab and Muslim in the world would give a damn about America. They hate us for our own injustice. But now you just mentioned that Hillary Clinton, you've talked about her a lot. Now, she and Bill released their tax returns. They made $10 million. They paid $4 million in taxes. They made $6 million. Now, I was an engineering manager. I made $100,000 a year, and it would take me 60 freaking years. I'd be 152 years old to make what they made in 1 year. And she's talking about representing the middle class and the blue collar workers who get by on 30, 40 thou. I mean, is that sick or what?
It's not sick. If her background, she comes from that background.
That's not the point. The point is that our leaders are, it's no different than the Middle Ages when the king had the castle and the gold and everything, and you were a serf. Now we've got billionaire Trump and billionaire Clinton running Wall Street,
I think that an important distinction here is that to pay 40% of their income in taxes, that's actually more than the highest tax bracket. So
it's very commendable.
Now,
money in one stinking lousy year. I'm not even talking about
that. Is not a crime, and that is not a reason to not.
It's
not a reason to not vote for them.
What do you think's happening to this country? Why do you think it's falling apart? Why do you think people are being violent and going nuts? Because some people make more money in 1 year than you'll make in your entire lifetime.
All right, I'm going to give you the last word on that because I'm running out of time.
That's the last word. I want you to respond to that.
I can't. Next week. Call me first next week. I'll respond because I've already got the music. I got 15 seconds.
Goodbye.
Take care. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Bob Gartner, thank you so much on control. Jazz Latino Juan Flores up next. And my quote for the sign-off today, nothing is perfect, life is messy, relationships are complex, outcomes are uncertain, and people are irrational. Hugh McKay, author in Australia. Have a great week. I'll see you then.
Many of us have great memories of KPFT. When we first heard it, what got us tuning in, and what we remember most. Inspired by the goodbye letter from former program director Ernesto Aguilar, we're collecting some of your favorite KPFT remembrances. Maybe it was that long ago DJ you loved, music you could never forget, or something in your own life that KPFT helped you to change. We want to know. We'll choose some of the best ones to read on air. Just send your story to robin@kpft.org now.
Wednesday, August 17th, two legends of Cuban music will take the stage at the House of Blues in downtown Houston. Mark your calendar for August 17th, when Buena Vista Social Club musicians Omara Portuondo and Eliades Ochoa will perform at House of Blues for one night only. One of the original vocalists for Buena Vista Social Club, singer, dancer, actress, and world traveler Omara Portuondo is part of a beloved musical scene in Cuba that produced a generation of innovators and pioneers. She is a legendary performer whose career as a vocalist has brought her worldwide success. She'll be joined at House of Blues by critically acclaimed